The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome along to the programme. Last one of the week, 4 minutes past nine. It is Friday, the 23rd of January. How has your Friday been so far? Hopefully it's going well for you, and you can stick around for the next 2 hours of the Greg Hughes Show, and of course throughout the day here on your favourite radio station, Highland Radio. We've got a packed couple of hours for you. Coming up after 10 o'clock, our Friday panel. As you might know, since the changeover, we've switched the Friday panel into the second hour of Friday's show. So we've got a cracking panel for you, discussing some of the big stories of the week and of the day as well. And we want you involved in that conversation. And throughout the morning, 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. Give us a call, alternatively, on 07491 25000. If you want to email, it's comments at highlandradio.com. And lots of you like to comment on our social media, because we stream the show live there every single day. We're across our Facebook pages and on the X platform and on YouTube, which means you can also watch it live on your big TV or your Fire Stick, if that suits you. Let's have a quick look at what's making the front and inside some of the papers this Friday morning. We'll start with the Derry Journal. And Hurt founder Sadie O'Reilly has called for urgent government action amid growing concern over nitazines, ketamine and other dangerous drugs circulating in Derry. In a stark message to those in power, Sadie O'Reilly, who founded Hurt after losing her son Tony to heroin addiction in 1999, said grassroots services were being left scrambled without dedicated, sustained funding while addiction devastates lives and end lives as well. We heard Ryan reference there the situation in Gaza. The US President Donald Trump, he's got a peace initiative, and he's sort of setting up a panel of peace. Ireland is invited, but it seems the powers that be are holding off on a decision. The Taoiseach has stopped short of closing the door on Donald Trump's so-called Board of Peace. The US President would be alternative to the United Nations unveiled in Davos yesterday. Micheál Martin said there were concerns around the initiative, but that Ireland was very anxious to contribute to peace and conflict resolution in the Middle East and Gaza. As he joined a summit of EU leaders to discuss Mr. Trump's threat of tariffs against several EU countries over their blocking of his ambitions to control Greenland, Mr. Martin said the Board of Peace was a much different proposition to the one initially envisaged. He added, "We will seek further clarification. We are anxious to contribute to conflict resolution, to peace in Gaza, and to support in a humanitarian way the situation there." But what would we be signing up for? I haven't really had a very detailed look of this at this Board of Peace, but the one thing I thought that was notable by its absence was any Palestinian people on it. And if you would have seen the plans unveiled by the United States as to what Gaza might look into the future, it's an open, free economy, which sounds good on the face of it, of course, but lots of big buildings, skyscrapers, data centres, all that kind of stuff. Tourist resorts, I'm sure, will be in there as well. But it's a very, very small area, and there's an awful lot of people there. So where are they going to live? Where is the plans to accommodate all of the people of Palestine? That is their home. So I think the Irish government would need to be careful what they're signing up to, because, obviously, of course, you can be complicit in something that's wrong as well. Russia might be involved in it, which is not agreeable to the British and others. So we'll see how that pans out. Do you remember we talked last month about additional speed cameras to be located in 390 different areas right across the country, many of them in Donegal? Well, there is a problem, because the Irish Times tells us that no additional speed cameras or monitoring hours have been committed to the recent addition of 390 mobile speed camera zones on the state's roads. It's emerged the number of such zones where GoSafe speed detection vans are deployed increased from 1,511 to 1,901 since the beginning of January. In a recent response to a dull question from Fine Gael TD Michael Murphy, Minister for Justice Jim O'Callaghan said the mobile safety camera programme continued to operate using the same number of cameras and monitoring hours as last year. The cameras and hours of monitoring are delivered under contract by GoSafe on behalf of On Guard Issy O'Connell. So it doesn't mean these cameras aren't located where they said they might be located, but there aren't any extra hours and there aren't any extra cameras, so the same resources are being moved around a much greater. Maybe that's not the worst thing in the world, but anyway, that's what the papers have to say about it. I don't want to pee you off on the last day of the week, and you're probably looking forward to the weekend. But of course, one of the biggest strains on our resources, all of our resources, is the cost of electricity. And the cost of electricity in our country doesn't make sense. We have one of the highest in Europe. Why is our electricity so high? That's hard enough to swallow when you're struggling. But the cost that the companies pay for electricity is coming down, yet our bills are going up. And it's impossible to make that make any sense. So reading on here, wholesale electricity prices have tumbled by more than a fifth over the past year. So that's down over 20%. But our bills, the domestic bills, and of course two commercial bills, are more than 5% up. Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine 4 years ago sent prices spiralling, the annual domestic electricity bill was around €1,000. But after sanctions against imports of Russian gas put the squeeze on energy prices, the figure is now around €1,800. That's a huge jump in a short period of time. Everything else seems to be getting on back to normal. And that's in no way to take away from the plight of the people of Ukraine. But, you know, we're seeing the price of oil tumble and other utilities, and all the markers, you know, are down. But electricity prices, we're still paying the big money. And I just wonder, have the electricity companies and the producers, are they holding in those rises because they're making money off our backs? Well, gas-fueled turbines generate half of our electricity. So the price of gas is a big factor in the retail cost of electricity. Wholesale prices last month were almost 21% lower than in December 24 and are also 72% lower than their peak in August 2022. So just to run those through those figures one more time. So before the big spike, our electricity bill was €1,000. Now it's settled at €1,800. Okay. But wholesale prices are 72% lower than their peak in August 2022. So they have come down, but those increases have been locked in. CSTO statistician Deirdre Toher said wholesale electricity prices dropped by 11.7% in December 25 when compared with November 25, and on it goes. But, you know, we'll be given the same old nonsense, right, that you have to hedge and you buy your resources at certain prices and then you have to lock them in. And it's, we are being screwed left, right and centre by the electricity companies. The worst thing is it's one of the greatest pressures on those with the least amount of money. 330,000 people are in arrears, and that's not including those who go without electricity because they're on pay-as-you-go, which they are counting their thousands as well. And the electricity companies are making an absolute fortune, both at retail and wholesale level, and no one seems to care except us. No one seems to really want to do anything about it, certainly those that are in power. Just a wee word of warning, not to startle you, but just another wee thing we need to keep our eye out for with our children. The heartbroken father of a young teenager who sadly lost his life from inhaling deodorant fumes has told how children who do this are rolling a dice. Daniel McGuire, just 14, a sporty and health-conscious teenager who loved the gym, died suddenly and tragically last September in his bedroom after inhaling fumes from a can of deodorant at the family home in Hartstown, Dublin 15. His brave dad, Dermot, spoke at the Joint Committee on Drugs Use yesterday to discuss the dangers of inhalants and the tragic day he lost Daniel. He said Daniel was a marvellous young man. There are some suggestions of putting potentially age limits on the buying of aerosols. And this is in no way to take away from the calls of the dad or the awful tragedy. But the reality is that I think the majority of them are bought by parents anyway, or are given as gift sets at Christmas. And I don't think putting another layer of regulation in terms of what age you have to be to buy a deodorant, I don't think that would have any effect, because I would say the percentage of deodorants that are purchased by people under 18, I think it's pretty low. I think it's mom normally gets it, or dad, or it comes in a gift sense from a gift set from Auntie Mary or something at Christmas. But anyway, it's still very important that we that we're aware that that can go on, right? And to talk about the dangers of it if you feel it's appropriate. Republic of Ireland fans are up in arms at the ridiculous price of the new Ireland jersey. It's the usual, green. Do you know the thing that annoys me most? It's got Sky written all over the front of it. And Sky are paying a fortune for this advertising, right? And it doesn't seem to offset the cost of the shirt. The Tatty and Offal shirts, €105 is the cost of the adult supporter shirt. And you're paying €105 really effectively, obviously, to show your support for the national team, but to be a walking billboard for Sky TV. You know, I mean, I would want the Sky off it, but I suppose you want it to look at the same as the footballers, right? Well, that's the price, €105, of the new regular fit jersey manufactured by Castor, with the pro model costing an eye-watering €145. What does the pro model do? The cheapest jersey available is for children, but even then, a new home or away shirt will cost fans wanting to kit out their little ones. What is that, €85? What's going on there? There's something seriously amiss, isn't it? They're really taking the hand, it has to say, we have to say. Patrick, hello, good morning to you.
Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm doing okay, Patrick, and unfortunately, you not so much. You've been the victim of a scam. Or the someone in the family
sister,
has been a victim of a scam. Go ahead, Patrick, it was your sister.
Yeah, so it was my sister during the Taylor Swift concert in Croke Park, I think it's probably 2 years ago. She's seen an ad posted for 4 Taylor Swift tickets, and I'm assuming, like a lot of people, she ended up getting scammed out of a total of €760. She reported the matter at the time to the Gardaí here in Letterkenny. There wasn't much that Revolut done for her, to be fair. They were basically shut it off, and it came to an end. The reason I contacted you was because the Gardaí rang her about a month ago to let her know that they actually traced down the individuals responsible for running the scam and that they were taking a prosecution against them. And they were welcoming her to join the case against them to strengthen their case. My thought was that probably there's a lot more people there that didn't contact the Gardaí, maybe out of embarrassment or didn't think there was anything that could be done. And it was just to share awareness that there is an ongoing case, and if anyone hasn't done so, they should probably contact the Gardaí at this stage, and just to let them know that if they were a victim as well.
Interesting. There's no guarantees, but there's a chance, and that's what it's that's what you're holding out for. It costs nothing to see what might come of this.
Yeah, exactly. There's no guarantee that she'll get a refund or get her €760 back, but it's worth a shot.
Yeah, okay. And was it the local Gardaí or national Gardaí that contacted her? Do you know off the top of your head, Patrick?
It was the local. It was
okay,
the Letterkenny station.
Right, ring Letterkenny station and say I was a victim of this as well. Okay, brilliant stuff. I think that's a really good advice. And I don't know what style of case it's been taken, because we don't do class actions as such in this country, but there must be something that the Gardaí are working on, and the more people involved, the better. All right, then. So, unfortunately, Revolut seem to be really poor at backing people up in terms of, scams, but that's not going to change anytime soon, I don't think.
No, I agree with you on that one.
All right, okay. Look after yourself, Patrick. Thanks for the heads up.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. His sister scammed, like many people, out of €760 for Taylor Swift tickets. This is going back a year or two when she played at Croke Park. You'll remember that. But the Gardaí contacted her and said, look, we found the alleged fraudster. We're going to take a case against them. Do you want to join that case as a victim? So contact Letterkenny Garda Station if you were scammed at that time, and maybe you can join too. As I say, I'm not sure if it's a means to get the money back, but certainly better than doing nothing. HICWA has launched a 6-week public consultation on its draft national guidance for the responsible and safe use of artificial intelligence in health and social care services. The guidance was commissioned by the Department of Health and is informed by an evidence review conducted by the aforementioned HICWA. Linda Weir is HICWA's Deputy Director of Health Information and Standards and is with me now. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I am good. Can you give us an understanding as to how AI, might operate or be employed in the health and social care services so we can have a greater understanding of what we might be inputting on?
Yes. So firstly, I suppose just to say that AI already plays a role in day-to-day life, very much so. And some examples that people will be very familiar with would be its use, for example, to generalise personal recommendations on streaming services like Netflix, or, you know, maybe to provide the best route on navigation apps like Google Maps. So there's some areas that people would be very familiar with, but may not be so aware of its use in health and social care. And it is already being used to an extent within these services. So, for example, in administrative tasks like scheduling appointments, or some listeners might have experienced their information being transcribed during appointments, so using a note-taking tool. So again, that's something that people might have experience of. And I suppose some of the benefits of that are that it enables clinicians to focus more directly on the patient during consultations. And also it ensures that all information is captured and recorded. So I suppose while it is in use in certain areas at the moment, we're expecting that this will grow significantly over time.
Mm. Is there any...
The health and social...
I mean, obviously, this is evolving, right? We're learning its capabilities and abilities all of the time. How have we mapped out how we anticipate the use of AI growing in health and social care services?
So that's being looked at the moment. And as I was saying, it's expected to grow significantly over time. And look, there's a number of challenges facing the sector. And, you know, it's been recognised that AI can help to address some of these challenges. But obviously, you know, it's an area where extra precautions are needed, and any technologies must be deemed to be safe and trustworthy. And any AI tool then must be used safely, and any risks associated with it must be managed carefully. Mm. So I suppose it's in that space that HICWA has developed this draft guidance. The main purpose is to promote awareness and build good practice among services and staff about the responsible and safe use. And it will really help to prepare the whole sector for the significant changes that we're expecting to see in this area.
Yeah, because of course, one of the concerns I might have, for an example, would be the security of my data. You know, whilst it's AI, is it ring-fenced, you know, within the services I'm using? Do scrubbing models have access to it? Is it stored in the cloud? How can I be sure that, you know, the notes that are taking on a consultation that are being transcribed using AI are fully secure?
So I suppose there's assurances at different levels, and there's a number of different things at play here. So there's legislation at a European level. People may have heard, you know, about the EU Artificial Intelligence Act, which sets out very particular safeguards and strict areas of compliance for both people who are developing the tools actually as well, and what, you know, what the threshold that they need to meet. And then once the tools are actually being, you know, where a decision is being made to use a tool within a service. But I suppose, you know, when a service is identifying if they're going to start using a tool, they need to look at all of the risks. And, you know, information and data protection is one of the areas that will need to be looked at in each case. And they need to be confident that, you know, firstly, that any potential benefit will outweigh any risks with the use of a tool, but that they have safeguards in place, that there's strong governance arrangements, and there's information practices in place, information management practices in place that will protect and safeguard people's information. Mm. Then coming, I suppose, from the management level, you know, there needs to be training for staff using the tool to make sure that they're using it appropriately and that they're meeting those requirements and that they know what it is that's expected of them and how they can protect people's information. And also, I suppose, one other thing that, you know, a lot of things, but one other thing that the guidance does emphasise is the importance of people being informed about AI tools being used in their care, that they have this information, that services are transparent with people around how tools are being used, and that information is communicated very clearly. And that's, I suppose, one of the key components of all of the documents that are emerging in this AI space, is around that importance of transparency and public engagement, and that people know that this is happening.
Yeah, with all that in mind, Linda, would it not have been best practice, good practice even, to have this guidance in place before AI was employed at all?
I think it would have been too soon. I think there was, you know, there's a lot of unknowns. This is coming in response to, I suppose, what is very much a dynamic and evolving area, Greg, and both in terms of the type of tools that are being developed, but also in terms of putting national policies and strategies in place. So HIC was working closely with the Department of Health and the HSE in that regard, and lining up all of the work across the three organisations to ensure, you know, that there's an integrated approach to this. Mm-hmm. So the national legislation is being worked on at the moment. The HSE is developing a strategy. So there are still some unknowns. So I think in that sense, I think the timing is right for this. And it's about raising awareness among staff and among services, and trying to ensure that people are ready within the services, but then also that people using services, their families, carers, are informed about this.
Okay.
And now have the opportunity to feed into this guidance.
And where do people access this public consultation?
So it's available on the HICWA website, www.hicwa.ie. It's going to be there for a period of 6 weeks, so closing on the 6th of March. And we very much welcome feedback from, you know, management within services, staff at all levels, working in all health and social care services. And as I mentioned, very importantly as well, people who are using the services and, you know, who are experiencing this day to day.
All right. Thank you very much indeed, Linda Weir, HICWA's Deputy Director of Health Information and Standards. Now, you may be aware, or maybe you're not, this is why I'm mentioning it, that we have a sister podcast to this programme with episodes released most Fridays. And on this week's podcast, it's, you know, regular people with regular stories or remarkable stories, really. It's, you know, we're not hunting out necessarily, you know, famous people, if I could put it to you like that there. It's just real stories and real experiences, real opinions and real conversation. Jerry McKeever is our guest this week, and Jerry's got an interesting story. He's been a barber in Letterkenny for 40 years, has his ear on the ground. He tried his hand at elected politics and is also an author. He's got his own views on you know, the future governance of this country, how it might be run. You can agree or you can disagree with him in relation to that. But here's just a sample of the podcast, which is live on our website from 9. And in this segment, we kind of just were debating really where we're at in this country and where we could end up.
I'm hoping to get 70 people elected.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I'm hoping to you know what I mean? Like, again, look, I know it's idealistic, but I'll get that in a wee while. And like, maybe some people might turn off now, they think I'm crazy. But look, I think theoretically, the book makes sense. Practically, who knows? I think enough to get behind it can work. But the point I was making was, you know, if we get those good people elected, who I regard as good people, hopefully people of integrity, then they can look in the budget and see where do we spend the money first. And they do say, you know, you judge a society by the way it treats its elderly, and it's impoverished. And we need more empathy going in that direction. We have to have it. But I think really, you know, the secret of fixing our cost of living crisis for everyone is that we must make accommodation more affordable. Mm. If accommodation come in, if we do the massive infrastructural project, if we can then relax planning permission because we can build in more land, if land's cheaper because there's more land for sale, if you're allowed to build your modulars that they can build in the continent, if you can have a house up for 180 grand, then you can afford your mortgage. Then you've got maybe 600 quid a month extra in your pocket tax-free that you're not paying out in rent, but you're paying a mortgage at 60% of the price. Then you can go out and use the shops. Then you can go out and keep money circulating in the economy. That is how you fix the crisis and the cost of living.
So he has his philosophies. You can agree or disagree. We do tease it out, and obviously I'll put in some counterpoints there. But it's an interesting conversation, especially if you're interested really in how this country is governed and if there's any alternatives, how Letterkenny has changed, how business has changed, the pressures on business, and whether or not he might consider running for election again. So that's going to be live on our website from 11 o'clock. So you can listen to that. Radio Buncrana Pantomime Society is celebrating 50 years of music and laughter with a production of Cinderella. Nicholas Crossan is a dame. And he's also actually going to be starring in this. He's also going to be starring in this production as well. Willie Doherty's chair of the society and producer of the show. Hi, Willie.
Thank you very much for having us, Greg.
No, it's our pleasure. Yeah. Hey, Willie, it's astonishing, isn't it, to be celebrating 50 years? It's an incredible milestone.
Well, it's a great milestone for us, and it's a great milestone for the community of Buncrana. And we're so delighted to be able to do this for them and the support that they've given us over the 50 years, the past and the present members who come forward without any hesitation to take part in the various shows that we've done over the years. And not only that, the benefit to the community that they have brought over 50 years, because all profits from 50 years pantomime went straight back into the community.
Willie, how long have you been involved? Were you there at the get-go?
I was there from the start, but I was a stagehand for the first couple of years, and then I moved on to the stage to doing various roles and different things, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure over those 50 years, what I think would be amazing, because it's so community-based, is seeing, you know, young ones involved, and 10 years later they're teenagers, and 20 years later they're the old hands. You know, it's been around so long, and it's so local. It must be remarkable, Willie, to watch that and how people progress and come through, and more talent always on the way.
Always on the way, and as I say, people started as fairies and they moved, as you say, moved on to parts, lead parts, and that. We even have a few weddings out of it as well.
There you go.
You know, people met at the cast, but it was a great thing for people coming new to the town and various different jobs, banking or whatever, and they could join and meet the community and make friends and stuff like that.
Nicholas, you know? When did you become involved in the...
I was neither fairy soldier or anything else. I was thrown on the deep end only last year when all my peers and has retired, Greg, 30 years ago. I got thrown into last year to the part of Dame, and that was my first pantomime in 50 years, and I'm enjoying myself.
You know, it's never in life, you always have to take, I was going to say never too late, but I don't want the age implication in that, because that's not what I mean. But it's, you know, we should always challenge ourselves to try something new, right? So it probably wasn't on your bingo card when to be a dame in 2025, if I could put it to you like that.
No, actually, probably in July of 2025, I had no idea. But then they were saying there's a shortage of a man for the pantomime. So I says, I'll go down, and whatever Willie tells me to do, I'll go and do it. But he told me to be a dame, and I said, all right, we'll give it a shot. But the reason I never got into it before, because I was always working or doing something, and I could never commit to it. But now when I'm retired and all I got, Greg, I'm committed to it. And as you just tapped on... the very first point that you made regarding the young people, the amount of young people is in this year and the amount of talent is unbelievable. And I'm sure the mammies and daddies and grannies and grandas will be really, really proud of their children and grandchildren when they go and see them on stage singing and dancing and enjoying themselves. It's great altogether, Greg.
Willie, is a good dame? Willie, yeah. Is Nicholas a good dame?
Well, he is. Just have to try and keep them quiet sometimes, the things he comes out with. But I suppose that's a politician coming out on him.
I know, Dame 2 years in a row. You don't want to get typecast either, Nicholas. So, you know, you want to spread your acting wings a bit.
Oh, gee, I don't know. Like, as the man says, you don't know how to seek too long either. There's an awful lot of young talent about, and I'd love to see them coming on board. And I think this 50 years with the new talent and the very young cast that we have, I think that it'll ensure that the Buncannon Pantomime Society will go on for a few years yet, because, as I said, the amount of talent is unbelievable.
Yeah, but I think I think choirs, amateur dramatics, pantomime plays, I think that actually benefits from a broad spectrum of the community, from the very young to the not so young. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's a strength, not a weakness. So you don't have to step away anytime soon, I don't think.
Yeah, oh no, I'll not be doing, and not only that, but I'm getting, and I know it's always dangerous to single out one person, but my sister in the pantomime, my dame sister, Donald Kearney, who has been there for 30 years and has done various different parts, keeps me on the straight and narrow. So it's great to have somebody, as I call him, my older sister, but he's actually, I think after Willie, I might be the next oldest. And I'm not saying, Willie's a couple of years older than me, but not many.
Hey, Willie, Nicholas talked about being able to take on different projects now that he's not quite as busy between politics and what have you. I mean, obviously you try and not use up people's time unnecessarily, but a lot of work goes into a production like this. Like, you know, rehearsals began months and months ago, so there's a lot of effort and commitment.
You see, we have a great committee, and I don't like to be a name it because we'll be here forever, but we have a great, and I would just like to shout out for thank Neil and the committee of 50 years ago for coming up and deciding to do the One Crown of Pantomime through the years. And you were talking about the dames there, and I am talking about the grassroots. I would have to mention Andy McCracken and Joe Grant, who were dames for a long, long time, and Eddie Murphy, and Una McConnell, who's the same, and they made their bit of history. So the dames after that have to make their bit of history. But the rehearsals is twice a week. People give them their time. The families, members drive them to and from rehearsal, and it's just a brilliant community effort. And that's, I can't stress that enough. It's to do with the community and the support we get from the town, the business people, sponsorship, everything is brilliant. You know, it just couldn't be any better.
I really didn't think we were going to be doing the Buncrana Dame Hall of Fame on the show this morning. But, you know, I'm here for it. Go on ahead, Nicholas.
Yeah, yeah. But it just showed you, Greg, just if I can, the community spirit that at last year I was doing dames in my first year. I got 1 week done on the NFL 6 so that I couldn't do the second week on it.
Yes.
And it was about 4:15, half four on a Monday evening when I went out of the hospital. And Stephen King, who I'm sure wasn't in the pantomime for over 20 years, stepped in for the last week to do it. And, you know, I was rehearsing for months, and Stephen stepped in on the day. That within 3 or 4 hours' notice, yeah. And went in and done my part for the last week. And, you know, that is the community that we have in Buncrana, and it's great to see it working.
All right, the show is Cinderella. It's got a young, vibrant cast this year, along with some more mature members.
Thank you.
And of course that they help each other, I'm sure. One keeps the others young and the others keep the other right. And it kicks off on Sunday, January 25th with a matinee at 3 p.m. until Saturday, February 7th in St. Mary's Hall, Buncrana. Both Sundays include 3 p.m. matinees with evening shows at 8 p.m. The matinee tickets cost €8. Evening shows 12, and there's €8 concessions on Mondays and Tuesdays. And what has happened over the last 50 years, all of this money goes back into the community again. So it's of the community, for the community. The show itself, Willie, Cinderella, it's a classic, isn't it? We don't need to flog that horse,
no,
but let's
you don't
do it anyway.
The only thing I want to say that from Neil started the pantomimes, and I would have went as a child to St. Columbus Hall in Derry. We do the pantomime in a traditional way. We like to fit the music to suit the scene or the scene that's coming. We just don't throw on any type of music. And just on the dames, we actually have people that come to the pantomime to get heckled. And if they're not heckled, they're in bad humour about it. And that's what they do.
Here's a secret, Willie. That's why I come to work every day too.
I know, yeah. No, just again, I just can't thank the Buncrana and the committee members. And I just want to mention all committee members, past and present. I don't want to name individuals. They all know who they are and how much I appreciate, and everybody appreciates what they're doing.
All right.
And long may it last, and hopefully they'll carry the torch on in another 50 years.
Right. Nicholas, keep yourself wrapped up in cotton while you're doing the full run this time, all right?
Well, I signed up for 2 weeks this year, so I did. Hopefully, Greg.
he's looking fit anyway.
He is indeed. He is.
Just in case, you're saying you're 100% right, but there's only a matinee on Sunday. There's no evening performance on Sunday. But
right, okay.
Saturday's yeah. Matinee on Sunday. And the tickets is on Ticket Source. Or the phone to Mary's all between 7 and 8.
Right, so on Sundays, there's matinees at 3 p.m. And
yeah.
Then for the rest of the run between the 25th of January and the 7th of February, it is 8 p.m. each night.
Yes.
And there's concessions.
And beginning else in Buncrana, it's 8 p.m. sharp, so get in there.
Ara, would you stop looking at your watch for once in your life? I'm sick of you pulling us up on our timekeeping. It doesn't matter if it's the Christmas lights, Halloween, Panto. Just take the watch off your wrist and relax, Nicholas. We'll turn up at 8:05 and that'll be that.
You'll miss the first song and you could miss something very important,
sweet. Oh, money messing, of course. 8 p.m. sharp. Gents, look after yourselves. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye. Lovely to see you. Chat to you, Willie, by the way. Particularly, right, I chat to Nicholas regularly, so that's why I give you particular mention. Look after yourselves. That's Nicholas Crossan, who is a dame in the Boncrana Pantomime Society's 50 year celebrational music and laughter production of Cinderella. And we also chatted to local legend there, Willie Doherty, who's chair and producer. So get along to that. It sounds like it'll be fun. How do you book tickets? Well, they are available at St. Mary's Hall each evening from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Or you can go online to ticketsource.com/Boncrana-Pantomime-Society. Right. We'll probably link that on our Facebook. There's all those dashes and I don't know in this day and age why URLs, as they're called, have to be so blooming complicated, especially like ticket booking, GoFundMes, Eventbrites and all that stuff. But anyway, maybe AI will have the answer at some point. It is the Greg Hughes Show here in Highland Radio. Coming up after 10 o'clock, we've got our Friday panel and we're going to be discussing some stories of interest to you, I hope. I'm joined on the programme now by Paula Crotty, who's founder of Cared Ireland. It's a voluntary organisation representing parents and carers of people with eating disorders. Paula, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
The one thing I could never get my head around, Paula, and I remember going back a long time ago into my 20s, and there was someone in our friend's circle that had an eating disorder, and back then it was just not taken seriously. It was hard to get people to understand. And then if they did, it was hard to get treatment. And I remember there was a battle on to get a seat down the a bed down the country. And it took yonks and yonks and yonks. And here we are, it feels like 30 years removed. And things haven't really improved much.
That's right, Greg. That's the sad story, I suppose, of what we're dealing with here. I mean, I suppose I have to say, in general, things have improved somewhat. We've gone from having little or nothing 10 years ago, and we do now have 11 teams that are specialised in eating disorders and helping and supporting people with eating disorders. I suppose the people that are struggling and their families would say that not all those teams are trained up enough, and they're not always fully staffed, but there are still 14 counties in Ireland that have no specialised training teams specifically for eating disorders, which is very sad. And I suppose going back to your 20 plus year history, 20 years ago there was 3 beds for adults in Ireland in St Vincent's Hospital, and here we are 20 plus years later and it's still the same.
Why is this an area of health, mental health, that continues to be such a struggle to get the resources to help people that need the help? Have you considered why that might be?
I imagine that an awful lot of it is there's still stigma, I suppose, related to mental health in a lot of cases. And in particular to eating disorders. I mean, we have patients who are still going into hospitals, who are still going into CAMS, AMS units, who are still going into eating disorder units, and sometimes going into these specialised teams and they're just saying, eat, just eat. Just put the food in your mouth and just eat it. What's the problem? Is people don't understand. And as a result of, you're looking for attention. So it's never really obviously been taken seriously. And I suppose from a parent and family standpoint, I know when my daughter developed it, we just thought that this was a matter of time, you know, a matter of a few months. She pulled out of college in January. We thought she'd be back in September. We thought there was nothing to this. And all of a sudden, years and years later, she was still struggling, and I think people just are lost and they don't know what to do and they don't know where to go. And I know for ourselves, we were afraid to speak out because we were afraid it would affect our daughter's treatment plan with her team. So I think it's fear on the part of parents and carers. And I think an awful lot of people say they feel so alone. They don't realise that there are so many other people out there that are struggling. And I think it's only in the last few years that we've really pushed this. And I think we as a group, Cared Ireland, we're a voluntary group of parents and carers who all have or have had a loved one with an eating disorder who are fighting to make this better known and for the services that our loved ones deserve to have, to be treated and to be looked after with respect, as every other medical patient does.
Very sadly, you lost your daughter, Jennifer.
So Jennifer died almost 3 years ago as a result of an eating disorder. I suppose we were fortunate enough to be in the catchment area of St. Vincent's and had a bed there for quite a while. I suppose I've kind of said in the last few days, I'm not sure I've ever really had said it before that, but I do sometimes wonder to myself if there had been proper services at that time, would she have recovered? I guess we'll never know that, the answer to that. But she struggled hard for a long time, and we had to fight against the HSE to eventually get her to London because they didn't have the services here. And it took them a long time to realise that. And when she came back from London, she had a bit of therapy here for a while. Then her therapists retired, and after that, there was nothing for her. So, yeah, it was a long, hard battle. It's a long, hard battle for everybody.
It's a parent's worst nightmare, and it's astonishing, Paula, that you're, with everything else that's going on, I know you've other children as well, but that you can draw this strength to advocate so strongly on behalf of Jennifer, but also so many other families that are going through this. It's estimated 80 people are thought to die from an eating disorder every year. But then there are many others who have potentially lifelong consequences. Maybe fertility could be affected. You know, obviously we focus on the 80 lives lost, but there's many more, many hundreds more, I'd imagine, that are going through it, but also can end up without the timely intervention with some of the long-term issues that I referenced there.
Absolutely. I mean, the truth is early intervention is vital and gives that person the greater chance of recovering from it. And there is such a thing as recovery. There are people who have very successfully recovered from an eating disorder. And I think that's a very important thing. The hard facts of eating disorder services in Ireland is there are 14 counties in Ireland who don't have any specialised eating disorder teams. That's a fact.
Is Donegal amongst those, Paula, if you don't mind me being parochial for a moment?
Donegal is one of those that doesn't have a specialised eating disorder team. It does have a CAMHS team and some clinicians there that have taken an interest in eating disorders and have done a bit of training in it. But Donegal does not have an eating disorder trained specialised team.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think when you look at the numbers that are out there and you look at the number of people that they're saying 80 per year that have died, those numbers we don't even know if they're accurate. No. First of all, there's no data collection for all the country.
Yeah. And you could have organ failure that would not be attributed to it, for an example. I think that probably is the thin end of the wedge, Paula. And listen, I think it's so important what you're doing. I really appreciate it. There's a paper system there, i.e. if you were to Google, you would think that we have a far better system than we actually do, because everything needs to be fully staffed, extended, more beds. And Paula, I can't thank you enough for the work that you're doing, but also for coming on and speaking to us today.
Greg, I'll just say one more thing, just what you're saying there about the numbers. The numbers that are reported by the HSE, those are the numbers only for the 11 teams that they have around the country. Those numbers don't reflect, those are not a true reflection of the number of people in Ireland who have an eating disorder, because they have no records of people that are dealing that have an eating disorder in those 14 counties that have no services.
Okay. Paula, thank you.
And I suppose
one last thing
I'd like to say is this is not looking at any one individual or any one consultant. This is not putting blame on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
This is not putting blame on consultants. This is down to the HSE and this is down to our government who are not providing. This is a system failure for people who are struggling with eating disorders and their families.
Okay, Paula, look after
and, and I suppose if I can finish up, who has a family who has somebody struggling, we're caredireland@gmail.com. We're a voluntary group of parents and carers that support each other.
It's amazing what you do. And we'll make sure to share that information on our socials as well as we broadcast it there now. Paula Crotty, thank you very much indeed.
The Friday panel on The Greg Hughes Show.
Author and journalist Cathy Donaghy, thank you very much for joining us this Friday. How are you keeping?
Morning, Greg. How are you doing?
It's great to have you as part of our panel. Councillor Niamh Kennedy, independent councillor in the Donegal Municipal District. Good morning to you, Niamh.
Good morning, everyone. How are we?
Good, good. James Ward, who's news editor at the Irish Daily Mail. Hiya, James.
Morning, Greg.
Great to have you on board. Quite a bit to get through. Just one that's come across the desk here a couple of times over the last day. I'm not sure if it's reflective of a broad opinion out there or if it is perhaps maybe a Facebook post that's got a bit of traction. But there is an event planned for the 1st of February in Letterkenny, and it's between 2 and 4 p.m. on the Radisson Hotel or in the Radisson Hotel in Letterkenny. Now, we know we mark St. Bridget's Day now, the public holiday introduced in 2023, I believe. And there's an event combining World Hijab Day and St. Bridget's Day. It's a celebration. And the subtext to it is a focus on similarity, not difference. Now, personally, to be honest with you, I didn't get the potential outrage in relation to this. But Cathy, I might ask you if that's okay. Do you think this is diluting a national figure like St. Bridget's Day, or is it an obvious thing for women to come together on?
I don't know how this could cause outrage. I suppose people are always outraged about something. But I suppose the idea of St. Bridget as a figure is one of inclusion for women. You know, women in this country have been underrepresented, and I suppose very much in a secondary place for so many years. I feel, someone said to me, I've been sort of writing about Bridget a lot this week for something I'm working on, but somebody said something to me this week which I think encompasses Bridget. There's room under Bridget's cloak for everyone, right? And that just resonated so deeply with me, because I think that's what Bridget is. She is, you know, she's a patron of blacksmiths. She's all about protection of the home. She shows what a powerful woman can be. You know, she ran her own church in 600 at a time when women weren't allowed to work. She had followers. We know she was charismatic. She is also, you know, patron of this land, of nature, of everything that grows. I think exactly that. There is room under Bridget's cloak for everyone, no matter whether you are faithful, whatever that faith is, whether you're pagan, whether you're Christian, whatever you are. And Bridget represents, if she speaks to you, then you're welcome. That would be my take on it, Greg.
Yeah. And also, this is a sisterhood, isn't there? You know, women, yeah, regardless of what their background is
absolutely,
both different groups having something to celebrate on the weekend. And also, too, we do actually have to coexist. It isn't about Christianity destroying another religion or vice versa. But anyway, Niamh Kennedy, I know you work in the inclusivity area quite a bit. I presume you don't see an issue with this. I don't want to put words in your mouth, of course.
Sorry, something froze there. Were you speaking to me, Greg?
Yes, I was, Niamh. I was saying, I presume you don't see an issue with this event.
No, I don't see an issue with it either. I would agree with Cathy all the way. I mean, everybody live and let live and celebrate women for what it is. I mean, St. Bridget, absolutely. The start of our spring, the start of growth, the warrior that she was, the fantastic myths and tales and stories of Irish culture is just prevalent with us. We celebrate that. We respect that. We also respect every other woman also. and I have no issue with it whatsoever. And I think good luck to anyone who would like to share that day with us. Yeah.
James, I'm sure you're not going to throw your laptop out of the window in anger either.
No, I can't say I am, Greg. Okay. I'm not sure what the criticism of it is, really. I mean, one of the things that we hear, and as you said, we all have to coexist. And one of the criticisms we sometimes hear is that, oh, well, you know, the immigrants that come here don't integrate. And this is the perfect event to kind of facilitate that. And I think that, especially in recent years, I think the St. Bridget's Day Festival has seen sort of a revival, and we've seen sort of lovely trends of mothers and daughters going out and getting matching Bridget crosses tattoos and this kind of thing. And I think it has been a kind of a great point for women to come together, and I think that should be as inclusive as possible.
And listen, for those of you out there listening who do have an issue with this, I don't want you to think this is some sort of a pile-on. I just chucked this in here in the last few minutes. It's just me genuinely, and often I can sort of get an understanding or relate to where concerns may come from, but this is just one of those things that I don't see personally. I'll stay with you if that's all right, James, because following last week's Supreme Court ruling that supports suspects can be forced to give up their passcodes for their phones, and the minister's new bill to give Gardaí access to encrypted apps like WhatsApp, is there any concern that the line between public safety, in other words, we need to do this right because of these nasty criminals, and our own personal digital privacy, is there any danger do you see that those lines now have been crossed or blurred?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a concern when we see that, you know, Gardaí being given access to sort of WhatsApp messages, or, you know, again, apps on phones that we are told are encrypted end to end and have ensured your privacy, does not seem to be the case. This new legislation, we have seen software such as Pegasus, which has been used to decode phones in other jurisdictions. There's quite a lot of controversy attached to that in other regions. Now, we don't know if that's the exact software that the Gardaí are going to be using. I'm not sure that they've announced exactly what it is as of yet.
That's but the software with Israeli links, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yes, yeah. And then there's suggestions again that has been used somewhat inappropriately by Israel as well. So that's something I think Ireland would want to be cautious on. But in terms of, I suppose, privacy, you know, there's a balance to be struck. Obviously, there's a lot of talk from government now in terms of a digital ID, a digital wallet that's going to be linked to your revenue account. That they will be using to provide as a form of ID to verify for websites that might have explicit material, for example. And there is concerns, and people are, I think, are right to be concerned about the level of oversight that the government is going to have on your online activity.
Because obviously, you know, I think criminals of any substance now, or unless they're, I know it was cracked, but EncroChat, you know, Encro phones and all and what have you. I don't really have anything to hide. I don't mind Google knowing where I am and all that kind of stuff, because it helps me when I'm trying to get about with Google Maps and stuff, right? But sort of carte blanche access to someone's personal encrypted messages on a suspicion, it feels a step too far.
Yeah, and there was reports last year, which I found a bit unusual, that in terms of the, you know, the dodgy boxes, these fire sticks, that there was going to be a crackdown on these, and that the Gardaí were going to be examining WhatsApp messages and different phone messages as a result of that. And I couldn't understand what the legal basis for examining somebody's WhatsApp phones were. How would the suspicion arise? What would the threshold be for the guards to look through your messages? You know, is it sort of a fishing expedition where they're trying to find keywords, or are they able to freely root around and see what they find? It's all a little bit Big Brother.
Kathy, what do you think?
Yeah, I suppose what I think first and foremost is that the digital landscape in this country has so radically changed in 20 years. Like, the last piece of legislation we had covering this area was in 1993. Like, if you think on just the technology we have in our pockets and how much it has vastly changed. I mean, I was covering the courts in 1993, and, you know, in the space of those intervening years, you can see how much technology has come into every court case. Like, WhatsApp messages are being looked at, or you know, the intel that we get from phone masts. The communications is vast, and it has to play a very big part in our criminal law. So it makes sense that we bring our criminal law, you know, on the, what's on the statute books, up to speed with the real world that we live in. I do have some concerns that there has to be, as James said, that balance between the fairness and privacy of the individual and the right of, you know, the Garda to go and conduct an investigation. That really does have to be really looked at very, very closely. I would imagine, or for me, I feel that if there is a suspicion and that they're, you know, in the way that the Gardaí have to go and get a warrant to search, I feel that there would have to be a very, very narrowly defined, you know, circumstances around which the Garda could go and seek access to this kind of information. And, you know, this is all being played out now. And we see the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, you know, talking about this. I think that it's something that we can never take our eye off, because, you know, you read about, you know, what the Israeli government is doing with Pegasus, and the European Union thinks that is a way, way step too far for us. So I think it's about a real balanced approach to this, listening to the voices on all sides.
Yeah.
We're behind the door on this.
For a lot of people, though, it's going to feel like surveillance coming through the back door, because, say, for instance, on the recent controversy of people actually being harmed by AI images being created, and the fact the government really didn't, I don't think they really took any action in relation to that. They don't seem to want to do anything to protect children accessing pornography on their mobile phones. But this, potentially, to make sure people aren't using dodgy boxes or for whatever reason it might be, this is the element that we're actually concerned about. And when you look at it like that, you say, well, is there an ulterior motive? Because we seem to be...
I think, you know, we do have actually legislation on the statute books that would actually could go after people if they are, you know, creating sexual images of someone. We already have that on the statute books. We need to enforce it. The laws are actually there. And I think the government has been absolutely way too slow to slap down the social media companies in terms of what they have been riding roughshod into the lives of our children. That's true. These are very separate issues. I think the dodgy boxes, if you know, and as opposed to a serious crime being committed and you need those WhatsApp records, they are very separate. And that's where I think this legislation has got to be teased out. There has to be a very narrowly defined focus on what you need this information for.
Yeah, okay. Niamh Kennedy, do you have a view?
Yeah, I would think similarly. I know that the Minister, Jim O'Callaghan, has said that he was going to take it over to Europe to go through it again and to ensure that, you know, that it is correct. He feels it's imperative that we do this. It's very, very important that it is done. I can see both sides, absolutely. And I can also see how we are being invaded every day anyway with our phones in our pockets, no matter where we go, no matter what happens to us. You know, unless you switch it off. And even I think if you switch it off, you're still going to be imposed upon. And even by speaking on a topic, it comes up on your phone, not through, you know, whatever. So it's a very strange times that we live in. And I think that I feel very, very sorry for older people who really are not tech savvy. And I often think of people who are sitting at home. And I mean, how many times a day do we now get calls from criminals who are trying to take money out of our bank accounts
I find it remarkable that there isn't any technology between Comreg mobile phone companies that can't weed out clone numbers, etc. Yet this is the also look like, say, James, you're a journalist, right? You've got your contacts, you get your information. Let's just say I was very interested in what's on your phone and decided that maybe I could trump up some sort of a reason to go through your phone, and it could be advantageous to check what else was on your phone. You know, like, we really have to be careful that this doesn't have a impact on journalism integrity, for an example.
Yeah, that's a real concern, and those concerns have been raised by the National Union of Journalists and by Newsbrands, which is an organisation of the main newspaper titles in the country. There was a Supreme Court case in 2023 involving the journalist Emmett Corcoran in Roscommon, where he had taken video footage of an incident at a property in Strokestown, so the violent incident there. The Gardaí went and obtained a warrant without telling the judge that Mr. Corcoran had argued that he had journalistic privilege over the contents. But that went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Gardaí commissioner at the time, Drew Harris, took the case and lost. And the Supreme Court judge really highlighted that how crucial the protection of sources was to the functioning of our democracy, really. And for people who are not involved in journalism, sometimes that can sound like journalists are getting a little bit up on their high horse or something. But if you're trying to convince a person who has information that they might not want to share to you, that might put their job at risk or even their security at risk if they were to share that information, and they cannot absolutely trust you, they are afraid that the guards could seize your phone at any moment and uncover the information that they have passed on to you, that is really, really serious. And that would really impede journalists from the ability to do their job.
OK, that's the voice of James Ward, news editor of the Irish Daily Mail. We're also in the company of Cathy Donaghy, author and journalist, and Councillor Niamh Kennedy, an independent councillor in the Donegal Municipal District. Searches for electric cars are falling in Donegal while rising nationally. Niamh Kennedy, is this a lack of local interest, or maybe it's our charging infrastructure in the northwest, or perhaps it's just that we're outliers up here, regardless of what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's a number of issues, really, and I think the infrastructure is a problem. And I suppose because Donegal is so rural anyway, that a lot of people don't maybe want to take that leap of faith and trust in an electric car when there's very little charge points maybe in an area. And we were just in a workshop last week in the council, and they were introducing some in the district that I'm in. And funny, the only one in my area that I'm aware of is in Killybegs, and there's nothing beyond that. So if you want to go to Glen for the day in your electric car, you'll be a bit under pressure. So they are in the process of putting some in into Sleeve League and into the centre there and places like that. And
is that going to happen, though? Because I've done stories in numerous years about the announcement of such and such, like the most recent announcement of public charge points. Inishowen was ignored completely. There was none planned for Inishowen whatsoever. And the late, great Stephen McCattle often pointed out the fact that you couldn't go to Ardrahan and charge your car. And that's a great disadvantage when people are planning their journey. So you mentioned about we are going to see more of them. Are we? Because I'm going to have to trip over one before I believe it.
Yeah, no, I know. And we, as I say, just last week we had that workshop, and there's four planned, I think, for up the Sleeve League Centre. There's a couple more planned for on the other side of Killybegs, but still not enough, not near enough. I mean, when you see people queuing outside to charge their car, you know that we're in trouble. And the thought of having to wait for a length of time, and certainly anybody who's working and has to travel long distances, they don't really trust that electric car yet. And then the cost to be incurred in it also. So I don't know. I think maybe they're just not there yet. And I think we're not there yet. And maybe we've just...
maybe we're tapping into the cynicism, because a lot of these modern cars here, 500-600 kilometres per charge, you know. But we don't believe that's going to get us from Donegal Town to Bala Buffet.
Well, the traffic, sometimes you would wonder.
All right, okay. Have you made the leap yet? No.
No, and we just bought a new work vehicle, and no, went with a diesel, I'm afraid. Very bold, but had to do it. Yeah.
All right, Cathy Donaghy, what's different up here? Is it the fact that we're fully aware that there is infrastructural issues, or are we just a little bit of late adopters?
You know, I think that one thing that is unusual about Donegal is that we have a very strong reliance on the car. The car is king in Donegal. Like, we absolutely, I mean, the panic that comes into your, my car was off the road the other day, just I needed to get it to the mechanic. And the blind panic that comes into your, you know, because when you live in a rural area and you literally can't go anywhere, you know. So I do think we have an attitude. The first of all is that, you know, we need our wheels, and that maybe there is a slow adopting of the electric vehicles. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. The infrastructure is poor. We had a friend recently visited with an electric car, and he was searching all around maps to try and get a high speed. There are no high speed. He was driving back to Dublin. He was going to have to stop on the way down to charge up again, because there's no high charge, or I don't know the proper technology.
Yeah, the high voltage rapid chargers. Yeah, yes. Sorry, so in other words, you could have been there for 4 hours as opposed to 25 minutes to get enough charge. Yeah.
One thing that bothers me slightly, and I think that these figures, it's very early, it's only January yet, but one thing that bothers me slightly is that the green agenda across the board is sort of being sidelined. You know, we see it from the highest political office in the world, right? That the green agenda is just like, it's not real. Climate change doesn't exist.
Well, Trump jeered the EU for their stance on climate change.
And I just think, I mean, a lot of people, I'm not saying that it feeds into this, but a lot of people around the world are saying, well, do I have to care? Because America's telling us and that, you know, green agenda is a waste of time, that climate change is not real. What difference do I make if I have an EV or I don't? You know, these things do actually sort of filter down into the public consciousness. So I wonder, in time, will that be played out as well, Greg?
Yeah, because we get a lot of that in this program, and I've found myself the Kerry All Ireland Club Championships. The report in RTE was talking about bonfires all over Kerry celebrating it, and I was thinking, I'm trying to light this blooming artificial coal, right, because I don't have to damage the environment, and they're lighting bonfires in Kerry. I might be being infected by Trump. I don't know what's going on. James, what's your insights into why we're different up here in this area?
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons, and I was surprised to read that Donegal actually has the sixth highest number of EV charging hubs in the whole country. That took me by surprise. But then you see the rate of chargers is 1.3 per 10,000 people. Now, you can only imagine if that was the rate of petrol stations per 10,000 people in the queues that we would see. So I think it's a national problem, really. We haven't been quick enough on the rollout of the infrastructure. I think there is still a bit of maybe a misunderstanding, as you said, that in terms of how far these cars can go, and, you know, you'll be fine going from Bunnycranna over to Swilly or wherever else, you know, like with a single charge, that's not going to trip you up. But people do have a little bit of that fear that they're going to be caught out somewhere stuck at the side of the road. That hasn't been challenged enough. And I do think Cathy's right. There's a kind of a top-down problem here. Ever since Trump went back into office, it's almost like we've parked the whole issue of climate change. We're going to worry about it later on, even though we're getting scarily close to the 1.5, or maybe we're beyond it already, that kind of doomsday threshold that the UN has pointed out. It's kind of scary that we've just decided we're not going to do this anymore. But it is, there's also that thing of, well, you know, if Joe up the road isn't doing it, what difference does it make if I'm doing it, you know? And that's, I think we need to see a kind of a reversal on attitudes. And
yeah, I don't think we ever got quite as far as you're suggesting, and I mean that respectively, because I think there was something like 800 solar panels were installed on 800 properties across Donegal last year. I still think we're doing it not for the environment. I think it's right. I heard my neighbour, their electricity bill 1 month was €6 in terms of the electric car, you know, that it's cheaper than petrol or diesel, or if I insulate the house, I'll save oil. I think really the greatest motivator still, James, is not necessarily the green message, but it's when we feel that it's advantageous to us financially.
Yeah, absolutely. And if that's, you know, that's the way to incentivize people, then that's what has to be done, really. And I think we should be more focused on bringing your bills down, bringing the cost of petrol down, making, you know, the cost of living, we all know, is very, very high at the moment. So if that's the way that people need to be incentivized, I mean, and forget about trying to encourage people to do the right thing and maybe encourage them to think about their pockets.
Yeah, okay. Niamh Kennedy, how are we doing as a local authority in terms of practicing what we're preaching? And, you know, you're privy to the various meetings and initiatives that are being undertaken.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think that our climate action team are excellent in Donegal County Council. They do great work. They're very, very encouraging, and all of their own transport now is electric vehicles. I think at one stage they might have struggled a little bit earlier on with them. Maybe if they had a peer manager, had a long journey to travel, you know, it was a bit dodgy, or if you had to carry something quite heavy, it kind of slowed things down a bit. But they're all on the electric vehicles now. They've all got their charging points. But not only that, all of the public service centres themselves have all got insulation. They've got their new lighting systems, and all of that. And also throughout the county, you'll see too that the solar lighting and all of that as well is taking place. So they would have got quite a lot of money for that in the past, and it's working very well. And that is a great team that's there, and they do fantastic, phenomenal work, actually.
I want to stay with power just for a moment, because in James's paper this morning, wholesale electricity prices have tumbled by more than a fifth over the past year, but domestic bills are up more than 5%. Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine 4 years ago, it sent prices spiralling. The annual domestic electricity bill was around a grand, but after the sanctions against imports of Russian gas that put the squeeze on energy prices, the figure is now around 1,800 euro. So wholesale prices last month were almost 21% lower than in December 24. And this is the bit I thought was quite critical, 72% lower than their peak in August 2022. So that gives plenty of time for, I think, any, you know, hedging or edging or whatever it is, hedging to run through. So, I mean, obviously, James Ward, news editor of the Irish Daily Mail, we keep reading these figures and it feels like it's almost gaslighting, no pun intended, because, you know, who's going to take some responsibility on this? Who's going to sort of say, right, this is unacceptable, what can we do?
Yeah, so part of why we're still paying such high charges, even though the wholesale prices have come down, there is a lag effect in terms of when they fall and that's passed on to the consumer. But the reason that the bills remain so stubbornly high is because we have high kind of charges on top, charges that are go towards the maintenance of the electricity grid, etc. And that is keeping them stubbornly high. Now, this the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities is kind of the regulatory body there. It doesn't have any role in setting the prices, but it is involved in setting the kind of charges that we have in terms of maintaining the grid. And there's a bit of an issue in terms of neglect there, that maybe it hasn't been properly maintained over the years. We had, I think, a 1 euro minimum increase in terms of the base charges for maintenance fees not that long ago. There's no sign, really, that these prices are coming down at all. The difficulty we have in periods of inflation is that they go up very, very quickly and take a long, long time to come down. And
but it seems uniquely an issue here. We are paying the we have the biggest gap between wholesale and retail. There are other similar sized countries which have the same issues with infrastructure and development and all that kind of stuff. Their electricity prices are much lower than ours.
Yeah, and I think in Ireland we have the highest, among the highest, if not the highest, electricity bills in the European Union. And I think there has been a lack of urgency, really, from the government to tackle that in any sense. You know, there were, obviously we had the energy credits and they were withdrawn in the last budget at a time when the bills were still stubbornly high, and no real alternative put forward. We haven't heard any sort of plan to start bringing the prices down. It's a kind of an area that's under discussed, I would feel, in the Dáil. And I think there's it'd be nice to see a bit more initiative from the government on this, and a bit more recognition of the effect it's having on families.
Yeah, 330,000 families in arrears, and that doesn't include, as far as I'm aware, prepay customers who may go a day or two without electricity. Cathy, someone needs to grasp this, I think, don't they?
Yeah, it's almost like it's one of these, it just doesn't seem to change. It's like we keep talking about this. It's almost like we need a consumer champion to come in and really look at why are we an outlier in Europe on this, and what can be done. I suppose as a family who spent 9 days without power last year in the coldest time of the year, it can be really, really frustrating and hard to take when you pay your bills and your bills are astronomical and you're left without power for, and some parts of the country were weeks, you know. So obviously, yeah, we need to change things. That's for sure.
Mm. What do you think, Niamh?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose I'm from the business point of view. I know that small businesses were really, really struggling there in the last couple of years with the bills that were coming in. And it's good to see them starting to reduce again. But obviously the homeowner is the one that's always very affected. And it is a struggle. And I think people too tend to just stick to the one company for hand in a stick. They don't kind of shop around as much.
Electricity, it's not a space where there's a lot of variation. I'm a great shopper rounder, new word for you there, it's almost a sentence, with car insurance, home insurance, mobile phones, broadband, but I just don't see the switching value in electricity like some do. I think I froze there. I'm not sure how much of that you got, Niamh. I was saying, you know, shopping around with electricity doesn't work very well for me.
No, and I'm to be honest, I don't even like doing it. I think if somebody comes knocking on your door to change over, you might just let them in to do that, and then you don't want to deal with it again for at least another 2 to 3 years. So we're not probably the best at doing that. But like, it is frustrating, and I think a lot of people are being really, really cleaned. I think anybody that's with a company for a very long time anyway needs to watch their, you know, watch the rate and stuff like that that they're paying.
Kathy, Brooklyn Beckham's public breakup from his parents has reignited a fierce debate. Is the toxic label, which is often used and has been used in this case, just a modern excuse to abandon your family obligations? Or have we, as a society, moved past the idea that these biological ties excuse bad behaviour?
Yeah, gosh, this has just got so many air miles this week. It's all anybody's been talking about. I mean, I was reading a piece, and you know, it has for some people, it has created a sort of a, I don't know, maybe a distraction away from the very serious.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Elon Musk and Trump and Davos and everything else. At the heart of this, though, you know, you can't help come back to it, even though you're seeing the memes on Instagram and Victoria's wedding dance with the son. You know, you're laughing, right? But there's another part of you that's going, as a parent, you're thinking, oh my God, what would I do if, you know, your children stopped talking to you? It would be the greatest heartbreak, I think, that you could imagine. And I've seen so many pieces this week written from, you know, the mother's perspective. You know, this devilish daughter-in-law came in and took my gorgeous child away. And I suppose, you know, as a mother, that goes through your head too, right? But I think that first and foremost, family estrangement is not a new thing. It's not like, okay, the Beckhams are this sort of unicorn family, like gazillionaires. But I think this isn't, family estrangement is not new. I think it's been happening for years under the radar. People just didn't call it.
And I think because of the level of their celebrity, it amplifies the level of pain that you might try and inflict on the other party.
And you know, and then there's the other side of the coin, is that people will say, you know what, get over yourself. You've had everything handed to you your whole life. If this is the biggest, you know, first world problems. But you know what? What greater problem is there in human relationships than falling out with your family? I mean, it is nuclear. The one thing I would say about the Beckhams where I sort of have a problem with all of this is that they commoditized this child, since he was a fetus, you know. I mean, everything was sold for brand Beckham, and it's coming back to bite them in the backside. I do think that that is part of it. But, you know, like we've become very inured to this language of therapy. We talk about toxic relationships and narcissistic parents, and we all know the words now much more than we ever knew before. Relationships are complicated. The family structure in a modern world is so different than it was years ago. And then when other people come into that family unit, it's going to change things up and sometimes blow it up. I don't know. I feel at the heart of all this, despite the memes and the jokes that are going around, I do feel at the heart of this is a family. And the one thing I would say with a family is there's always room to mend fences. There's always space to heal.
And a Netflix series in it.
Yeah, I mean, the Netflix series really bugged me.
The reconciling of the Beckhams, you know, that unfortunately, you know.
Yeah, but it's just so inauthentic, Greg. I mean, if you looked at those relationships as they played out, and I mean, I watched them like everybody else, and I just felt this isn't real. This isn't how families go on. Number one, nobody has a kitchen like that, right? First and foremost. And the second thing is, like, you know, Victoria Beckham is, you know, she's the same age as I am, and I'm sorry, I don't see a wrinkle on that forehead, right? So look, these people are complete outliers, right? But an inauthentic is the word that Brooklyn used. Everything is a brand. Everything is pushed out to be, you know, to be looked at.
But I think maybe he needs to look inward as well about the privilege that he has. That if he wasn't David and Victoria's, if he wasn't their son, he wouldn't be on the arm of a model. You know,
Is that his fault?
No, but my point is, but sometimes we always look for someone to blame because of our problems in our life, and sometimes you need to look into yourself, right? You need to look into yourself and say, right, well, what about me? What can I bring to this situation? You know,
Yeah, you're right. I think that, I mean, there's two sides to every story, or three sides if you bring Nicola Peltz in as well, who's been I see this thing online that it's Team Beckham or Team Brooklyn. I really hate this that we, you know, everything is so reduced to a Punch and Judy show. It's like
I blame the blooming papers.
Yeah, well, I can't say that because my bread and butter too.
I know, and I'm also looking at James. Don't worry about that. I'll get to you in a second, James. Niamh, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, obviously this is a public spat, but just because we're blood related to some people who serve the day and age, it doesn't guarantee you're going to get on with people either, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, we have our own minds and personalities, and sometimes you have to go with that.
Yeah. I mean, every family has their issues, and there are always going to be conflicts no matter what throughout the years, throughout the decades. And the more siblings you have, and probably the more wealth someone has, if someone comes into that family like that girl who married Brooklyn. I mean, I don't follow them. I'm not interested at all. But I from this message, having a peep, I'm just looking, going, I can see the, you know, I can see the body language. I can see Victoria with her back, and she's upset. You can see she's visually upset. She's obviously very proud of her son. Doesn't want the fact that somebody to come in and take her son away. There's that protection thing. There's also that, oh, she's not blood, she's not our blood, we're better than all of that, which is really, really difficult for anybody to have to put up with.
That's bad parenting, because there comes a point whereby you're no longer a direct influence in everyone, in a person's day-to-day life. You're there really to, if they need to come to you, or maybe you can offer them, but a mum should not be that involved in a son's relationship, I don't think, anyway, or a dad,
no,
of course.
Not when they get to a certain age. And you know what? If they make the wrong decision and you think they are making the wrong decision, you're just going to have to let them do it and figure it out for themselves.
I mean, this has been all over the papers. I don't think you just went too big on it, did you?
No, just 5 pages a day, I think it was.
But it sells, though, doesn't it? I mean, because that's where the interest is. And Kathy made a really good point. It's a distraction. I mean, it's very serious for them, right? But Davos, Trump, we've never been so exposed to every issue going around the world as we are now. And sometimes we just do need that distraction.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it really struck a chord, number one, because we all have families, we all fall out, you know, everyone can relate to it. And also it was, I just think it felt like such a relief to have something else to talk about, yeah. You know, other than the end of the world or whatever. Okay. But I suppose this whole family estrangement thing is something that it has always existed. And the last few years, it seems to have picked up a little bit, and the New Yorker magazine did an in-depth piece on this, I think, a year or two ago. Because particularly in the US, and the number one reason, I suppose, for going at what they call no contact with parents was, in fact, Donald Trump, and that children couldn't reconcile the morality of their parents actually having voted for him, you know, and causing these big arguments. And, you know, you might put it to one side, but it always kind of crops back up and they fall out again. And there was a piece, I think, called The Rules of Estrangement, written by a clinical psychologist called Joshua Coleman, who himself had fallen out with his daughter. They reconciled, but then he did a big study speaking to parents and speaking to the children, and the parents always, you know, obviously devastating for them, but felt that there was very little wiggle room when it came to the children's perspective, that they were not going to budge. And if you look at a lot of these Reddit groups and stuff, really advocating for what maybe was kind of taboo was actually, no, you can cut them out of your life.
Yeah, that's so true. It is. All right, listen, James Ward, news editor at the Irish Daily Mail, thanks so much for your time. Have a great weekend.
Thank you
after yourself. Thank you. Niamh Kennedy, Councillor Niamh Kennedy, good luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks
to you
much.
Too. And always a pleasure to have you on the show. Cathy Donaghy, author and journalist. Look after yourself. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Just a couple of birthday requests here. I'd like to wish Mary Cole in Tonbain Fanad a very happy birthday today. Best wishes from Kathleen and all of the family. Could you please play a request for Finn Valley College on such a great performance last night? With all shook up. And congratulations to all the teachers and everyone who put the show together. Brilliant from Margaret, Mary and Kathleen. Well done, everyone. And we were at Finn Valley College a couple of months ago as they were building up to that, a super talented school supported by super talented and passionate teachers, which is lovely. Any comments we didn't get to, we'll carry them over to Monday, but that's where we leave it for Friday. Thank you so much for listening.